From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss the roots of China's student rebellion with one of its leaders, Shen Tong. He escaped to America after the massacre at Tiananmen Square, and he's now a student at Brandeis University. Also today, a phone call from prison. James Fogel has spent most of his life in prison, convicted for a series of drug-related robberies. Behind bars, he wrote the novel Drugstore Cowboy. The unpublished manuscript was adapted into the award-winning film of the same name. Now the novel itself has been published. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Passion. It's A.S. Byatt's novel of two Victorian poets and the two modern-day scholars that discover the poet's secret love affair while falling in love themselves. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Britain's Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher tonight threatened Saddam Hussein with military action if Iraq doesn't withdraw its forces from Kuwait. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
Thatcher was speaking outside her residence at 10 Downing Street in London. She had just emerged after talks with Secretary of State James Baker, who is nearing the end of 8 days of talks on the Persian Gulf crisis. The peaceful solution, Thatcher said, would be for Iraq to get out of Kuwait. We hope they will do it. If not, she added bluntly, we shall have to take the military option and see that Iraq leaves Kuwait. It was the sharpest threat yet from the Western leader who seems most eager to start the fighting. Thatcher also said she believes the legal framework already exists for military action against Iraq without approval of the UN Security Council. Baker has been discussing such a resolution throughout his meetings with foreign leaders. I'm Mike Schuster in London.
Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev said today that Iraq won't succeed in dividing the multinational forces arrayed against it. But he was evasive about Soviet support for the use of force to drive Iraqi troops out of Kuwait. Gorbachev made the remarks at the start of a 2-day visit to Germany. He said the next steps in the crisis will be up to the United Nations and declined to say whether Soviet troops would take part in any possible military action. The Soviet leader called the international embargo against Iraq a great victory and said the Gulf crisis was a test of the new politics of international cooperation. U.S. Secretary of State James Baker has arrived in Paris for talks with the French president in hopes of convincing France to support a U.N. resolution authorizing the use of force in the Gulf. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
This is the last stop on James Baker's diplomatic tour, and in some ways it could be the most difficult. Earlier today, senior U.S. officials said they were skeptical they could win French approval for using force against Iraq. France used to be one of Baghdad's staunchest friends in the West, and although it now has some 13,000 troops in the Gulf, Paris is not keen to become involved in a U.S.-led war there. French officials say President François Mitterrand would like to see an Arab solution to the conflict. News reports say he could ask Baker to delay a U.N. resolution until late November to give Iraq time to soften its position. Reports say French hopes for a breakthrough have been raised following Mitterrand's recent meeting with King Hussein of Jordan. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The United Nations General Assembly has turned down an Iraqi request to debate the Persian Gulf and the U.S. military presence in Saudi Arabia. The Iraqi request came in a letter to U.N. Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar. It asked that the proposed debate be added to the world body's daily agenda. Prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 45 points to close at 2,488.61. Advances led declines by a margin of more than 2-1. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After the massacre at Tiananmen Square in June of 1989, Shen Tong was the first student leader to escape from China to the United States. He's now a student at Brandeis University. In exile, he continues to work for democracy in his country, raising money and forming alliances with other freedom groups around the world. Shen has written a memoir called Almost a Revolution. On April 27, 1989, Shen Tong helped lead over 8,000 students to Tiananmen Square, convincing police to let the students pass. During the occupation of the square, Shen ran the Student News Center and organized the dialogue delegation, which negotiated with government officials. On the night of the massacre, Shen was in one of the bloodiest areas, just off Tiananmen Square. The dead and wounded lay all over the sidewalks. Army tanks were heading for the avenue while foot soldiers fired into the crowd.
I was totally shocked by the shooting, but by some point, the troops stopped, and with some other people, we hold a shirt from Coops, from somebody who died before and it's gone down by the other soldiers. And we're trying to show them and prevent them, you know, trying to show them what their comrade has done, you know, to stop their shooting. And so when we get in the middle of the road where all the trucks and, the, you know, soldier carriers stopped there, I was just started to talking. And when I started to talk, it just I just couldn't help to, you know, to keep going. And especially when I find out some soldier, you know, when I ask him, does he know where he is? He shake his head. It was very surprising. They were cheated by the government. They didn't know what they're doing. They thought, you know, it's kind of they're trying to push away some counter-revolutionaries or the or minority uprising, you know, to some of them were told they're getting to Tiananmen Square to save the people there. So, you know, I just talking to the young soldiers there about my age. And I didn't pay attention. Some officer on that truck pointed his pistol to me, and my friends draw me back. About the time he fired, but the bullet didn't catch me. Catched a girl stand right beside me. She was very young. She was like 19 years old, and I heard she was a freshman in a university in Beijing. And she got the bullet right on her face, and she just fell back and died immediately. I was trying to turn my body back when other people drew me on side road to have another look on her. But what I saw is just a bloody hole on her face.
After the girl next to you was shot, how did you get away?
My relatives and a friend of mine drove me back from the middle of the road to the sidewalk, and then they carried me on their bicycles to a place where they had me, to several places where they had me for a week before I finally fled out of China.
Can you describe what you saw of the massacre that night?
When I was there, you know, the troop, it's all still, I mean, when I reflect, all the still unbelievable. The troop, you know, with tanks and, you know, tens of trucks loaded soldiers rushing downtown area from the Eternal Peace Avenue. And they were shooting most to the sky and to the ground in front of the people. You know, there are thousands of Beijing people out there. They get used to that for 2 weeks already. They sleep during the daytime and they came out during the nighttime to try to stop the army's effort to rush in the Tiananmen Square and drive away the peaceful student hunger strikers. And although the government warned them, you know, there would be a serious action during the massacre night, they didn't pay attention to that at all. You know, I was feeling, this probably sounds very strange to a lot of Americans, I was feeling a festival atmosphere during the massacre night. You know, no matter what kind of thing you put to us, troops, machine guns, or even tanks, you know, you can't conquer our spirit. After, you know, 5 weeks or 7 weeks demonstrations, people spiritually completely conquered the Communist Party's control. So, you know, there were, although the soldiers were shooting and nobody left the street, and a lot of people gone down on the street, and people were still trying to stop the troops. And when the troop passed, you know, people followed the troop, and the soldiers on the trucks shoot at them. A lot of people on the front line lay down, but people just keep going. And still trying to stop the troop, and people cried out slogans to ask the soldiers stop shooting to the student and people on the street. But when people carried me away from the place where a lot of killing happened, I met several locations where the people catched some soldier and beat them up, and some of them, you know, just died by the angry people. So that's the time I felt so sad, you know, in the capital of my country, soldiers are killing people, and people are killing soldiers. Although it's the soldier initial, the confrontation, but there, I think for me, the soldier who died also victim of the Beijing regime, because they don't know what they were really doing. You know, they got this order, they were cheated by the government. But the whole situation was so sad.
You were one of the organizers at Tiananmen, but you were hoping to get compromises and talks with the government, and you were hoping that the students, the hunger protesters, would go home. Why did you hope that things would disperse, that people would disperse at Tiananmen?
Well, I started to involve in the political movement far before the 1989 movement. For the student organized activists like me and several others, we were really planning for the 1989 movement for a long time. And for us, we realized there must be enough lead period or evolutionary process before the mass movement happened. And I didn't think China was ready for a complete social revolution at that time. So, and also, probably a lot of people in the Western world didn't realize the pro-democracy movement in China is not only by the opposition political force. The internal reform, the reformers' internal struggle, internal power struggle with versus conservatives are also part of the pro-democracy movement. So on the one hand, we should go ahead to, you know, try to raise people's awareness as much as possible, try to push China on the reform road. On the other hand, we should protect the reformers who have already have their power inside the current government, you know, through that internal reform way, kind of Hungary's approach for almost 30 years, more than 30 years already. You know, so this is fine balance as opposition political force, and also gets a sense to cooperate, you know, with the reformers inside the government.
Was there a point when you and the other people who were part of the leadership at Tiananmen felt that you had lost control, that the crowd and the spirit had a life of its own? Did you ever feel that way?
Yeah, it's kind of... I had the feeling at the time, like, I started a car and somebody take away the steering system and I couldn't get off the car and the car is going to a cliff, you know. So that's time for a period of time when the movement, I was kind of lost power, I lost my role in the leadership of the movement. I was so frustrated. On the other hand, I thought probably it's the time, you know, probably we can make it, although the as a whole, the society was not quite ready. But seeing the large scale of the support we got, seeing the movement lasting so long, I was hoping, you know, the radicals in the student leadership, they're right, you know. And so although the outcome proved, you know, China was not ready, but I was really think of, you know, it's very controversy inside of me during the last part of the movement.
What had you planned and what had you hoped for? When you were one of the people who led around 8,000 students into Tiananmen, what did you think was going to happen and what did you hope was going to happen? What kind of ending did you foresee?
Yeah, as we talked before, there are different type of views by other student leaders, but for the people like me, and we're really planning in a long-term run. We want this progressive and gradual means. So we see the 1989 movement is just as one of the ways to push China forward. We were thinking that's a long way to go, but the outcome, during the movement, the movement itself spread out so rapidly, and we got such a large support. It's kind of, for me now, when I reflect all this, I think it's different approaches, different factors of pro-democracy movement, the internal reformers, the opposition political force, and the whole nation's general progress for the recognition of their political involvement. All these three approaches joined the effort together too early and too quickly during the 1989 movement. I think that's a mistake we made, and that mistake, I think, is inevitable. Whenever a country with a suppression, you know, so strong, like China, get in this kind of mass movement, it's just like a broken dike. No one, even on this side, like on the mass movement side, people like me want to plan, want to have, you know, really control. No one can really control it. So the next task for the future for us is to trying to keep this balance, you know, trying to find the right moment to, you know, trigger the mass movement.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Shen Tong. He's a leader in China's pro-democracy movement. After the massacre at Tiananmen Square, he escaped from China, and he's now a student at Brandeis University, and he's the author of a new book called Almost a Revolution. This is Fresh Air. Shen Tong is my guest, one of the leaders of China's pro-democracy movement and the author of the new book, Almost a Revolution. Tell me about your parents and their reaction to your leadership position in the pro-democracy movement. I wonder how they felt about young people rebelling. Were they confident that young people had the wisdom as well as the courage?
Yes, and people in China, that's one thing, you know, one of the main points I try to make through the book, which I want the people in the world understand, my generation, which is quite different from the generations in China previously, is sort of, I want people through this book, through my personal story, to understand this generation, how this generation grow up, where the 1989 movement come from, and based upon this, they can hopefully understand where it's leading to. But when I say my generation is very different, there are several aspects in this. First of all, you know, my parenthood and people even just older than us, like 10 years older than us, we call them cultural revolution generations, which is what they grow up in the period of 1966 to 1976, which is a big political campaign and a disaster for China. It's called Cultural Revolution, initiated by the Mao Zedong. And my generation is so-called open-door policy generation, which is, you know, we grow up in this open-door policy period right after the Cultural Revolution period, which is totally different economical and political situation. And my parents, my parenthood and the Cultural Revolution generation, they experienced a lot, they suffered a lot. So on the one hand, they, you know, they grew up generally in this chaotic period of China's history. They concerned very much about the China's political situation. On the other hand, they experienced so much suffering, so much bitterness. They can't really find out, you know, the way to participate, because there's no way to participate in the political movement in China if you're in the situation like Cultural Revolution, or all the political campaigns before the Cultural Revolution and after 1949, the founding of the People's Republic of China. So on one hand, especially family like my family, their intellectual background family, they brought me up in a very liberal atmosphere and have a lot of concern about the society and political situation in China. On the other hand, they really don't know exactly how to keep this balance. You know, you should concerned and unconcerned in a way about situation. You should concern mentally, but you should keep away, you know, from the real involvement. And I think what my generation has done and what we are doing is a great lesson for them, you know, because they are kind of, you know, give up in a lot of ways. They think they're still concerned, they still feel strongly for the future of China, but they don't really think they can make the difference.
And you know, but I'm wondering if a lot of the people of the older generation felt that the conclusion at Tiananmen Square confirmed their worst fears, that the pro-democracy movement, instead of permanently changing China, ended up in a massacre and a crackdown where freedoms that had been won before were taken away.
Well, there's certainly this reaction to the reality, but that's, there is another part which I think is more important, which is the student, and I think the people feel more strongly about this part is the student during this not only the 1989 movement but the 10 years movement before the last spring event really gives the people the opportunity to express themselves in the society, to vent their anger, to really involve without severe, you know, political trouble, involved in the social affairs. You know, student provides the chance for them to really taste freedom, although it's taken away quickly. But whenever people, you know, taste freedom, there's no way to stop them.
When you started becoming an activist on campus, were you worried about student informers and teacher informers? Were there a lot of people on the campus who would gladly inform on an activist?
The government system is very advanced in China. I think on a lot of aspects, China is quite underdeveloped, but in this aspect, it's very advanced. I mean, I don't know a lot in this country, but I think it's quite even more advanced than the Nixon period. And they have, in each department, they have, we also call them teacher, but they kind of take care of all the political issues from, you know, every student. They keep files on everybody. And this file is close to the person. You have no chance to see what in your file. And if something, you know, like political trouble, you know, they keep record in your file, you will suffer all your life.
After the massacre, you managed to escape from China, and you're now a student at Brandeis. Had you already been accepted to Brandeis before Tiananmen Square?
Since my involvement in 1988, I really worried, because after that movement, I got a lot of pressures, political trouble. I really worried if I can continue my study or not after I graduated from Peking University. So that's the time I started to apply American schools. And I was really lucky. I got in several schools before the 1989 movement started. But I didn't had time to prepare all the document, which this probably is hard for Americans to understand. The normal process in China for Chinese to get their passport and the necessary document is minimally 2 or 3 months. So I was so deeply involved in the movement. I even started to think I shouldn't leave China. This is a place I should be. And all of a sudden, massacre happened, and a lot of people, include my friends, my relatives, as well as influential people, like even the government officials, they helped out right after the massacre. And I'm the first student leader escaped from China. And since I was accepted already by Brandeis and a couple of other schools, so I'm just settled down quickly.
How do you like life on an American college campus? What do you like and what don't you like about it?
Well, this country's education system, I think, collectively is better than China, although there are a lot of disadvantages of it. But it's generally it's more creative. You have more you know, opportunities to really figure out in your in your 4 years undergraduate study, you know, what kind of academic as well as you know, social goals you want to achieve, which compared to China, you really, if you choose something, you know, even before you get in university, you got to stick to it. You know, you got basically no choice to change it. And also, actually, I have to admit this, I'm not quite a college student. I don't spend all my time on campus, or I try to. I'm a full-time student. Meanwhile, I spend a lot of energy in the exile movement.
Do you know if your family, who is still in China, has ever been punished because of your activism?
Actually, it's only my mother there, because my father died after I, like a month after I escaped from China.
What about your sister?
They get her a lot of trouble in her work unit. She has to change to a foreign company, and they took away her passport, so there's no way for her to get out.
And your mother?
And for my mother's case, because she is a medical doctor, you know, the government basically cannot do a lot to professional people, especially like doctors. And also her hospital, people there are very sympathetic to the movement. Actually, the head of her work unit, his son was my close friend in Peking University. So they're really sympathetic to her.
How do you feel about all the friends who you had to leave behind in China, friends who were behind bars now, or friends who died during the massacre?
Well, when I first came to this country, I felt very deep guilty, you know, to them, because I'm lucky I get out, and here is so peaceful, so wonderful compared with China, and they have to stay in jail. They couldn't continue their study. They got all kind of political troubles. But more gradually, I felt, you know, the only point for me to escape from China is to carry forward the dream we had together in China, and they couldn't do it now. I can carry forward it, and I felt, you know, they're the courage of me. They really deepened and strengthened my commitment to this dream. And I always felt, no matter, you know, where they are, you know, in labor camp or classroom, receiving re-education or real education, in prison or in their graves, in hiding or in exile, they're always with me. And I think they're always with people who love China. And they are the reason for me to keep dreaming, keep going on this odyssey. And I hope, I dream, you know, someday every student on every campus, and, you know, every worker in, you know, every factory, every citizen in every city and village across China will one day taste freedom. And I know we taste it. We're almost there, you know, last spring, and I know this taste is sweet.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Shen Tong is now a student at Brandeis University, and he has a new book on China's pro-democracy movement and the massacre at Tiananmen Square. It's called Almost a Revolution. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. 35 years in prison has given James Fogel a lot of time to think, read, and write. Last year's award-winning film Drugstore Cowboy was based on one of his unpublished novels about a group of junkies who rob drugstores to support their habits. Now the novel itself has been published. Coming up, Fogel talks with us from the Washington State Penitentiary at Walla Walla. And if your taste in novels runs toward the Victorian, stick around for critic Maureen Corrigan. She reviews Passion, a new novel that both parodies and pays homage to the literary blockbusters of 100 years ago. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. U.S. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney has given more information on U.S. plans to send large numbers of additional troops, ships, and tanks to the Persian Gulf. In a speech today before the American Conservative Leadership Conference in Washington, Cheney indicated that the Bush administration intends to match the current level of Iraqi troops in the area near Kuwait. NPR's Vicki O'Hara reports.
The United States has 230,000 troops in the Persian Gulf. Iraq has about 400,000 troops in and near Kuwait. Defense Secretary Cheney said this morning that a new deployment to the Gulf will include half of all U.S. land forces currently stationed in Germany. Those troops, coupled with a deployment of naval vessels, as well as troops currently in the United States, would bring the U.S. military presence in the Gulf to over 400,000 people. Cheney told reporters the new deployment and the U.S. forces already in the Gulf will be there for the duration of the conflict over Iraq's occupation of Kuwait. In Washington, this is Vicki O'Hara.
British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher says the military option will be used if Iraq does not pull out of Kuwait. Her comment came after meeting today with Secretary of State James Baker. The secretary said earlier that the superpowers will not be divided over the Persian Gulf crisis, but he would not say if a timetable for military action has been decided upon. The Iraqi foreign minister says the American plan to send more troops to the Gulf does nothing toward finding a peaceful resolution to the Gulf crisis. He spoke as former West German Chancellor Willy Brandt left the country after talks with Iraqi leaders. Bob Simpson of the BBC has more on the story.
At an airport news conference, Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz said President Bush's decision to send 100,000 more men to the Gulf was not helpful to the situation. He added that instead of deploying more troops, President Bush should send diplomats, people who understood the region, and try to open peace talks with the leaders involved. Tariq Aziz also said that though some of those involved in the crisis had taken positions that couldn't be changed by persuasion or dialogue, there are some positions that could have been taken because of lack of dialogue, misinterpretation, and misunderstanding. That's why, he said, Willy Brandt's visit and others like it were so welcome. The former West German Chancellor, who arrived saying he had suggestions for peace, said he wouldn't spell them out yet. He needed the weekend to go through his notes and consult his memory rather than improvise.
Bob Simpson reporting from Baghdad. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 45 points to close at 2,488.61 on volume of 145 million shares. Trading today was moderate. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. My guest, James Fogel, has spent 35 of his 54 years in prison. Now, for the first time, people on the outside can read his writing. There's a good reason why they might want to. His unpublished novel, Drugstore Cowboy, about four junkies who robbed drugstores to support their habits, was the basis of last year's acclaimed film of the same name. The National Society of Film Critics gave the film awards for Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Screenplay. Fogel's novel, Drugstore Cowboy, was published today by Delta. The novel was written in prison in 1977. Journalist Dan Yost showed the manuscript to film director Gus Van Sant, and together they adapted it into a screenplay. We arranged for Fogel to phone us Colette from the Washington State Penitentiary at Walla Walla.
I'm in a day room down in the bottom of the BMU unit here in this Washington State Penitentiary, and it's kind of noisy. You probably hear some noise in the background. There's guys playing dominoes and different card games and stuff. And they're not really paying much attention to me, and I ain't paying much attention to them, hopefully.
Is Drugstore Cowboy going to be in the prison library?
It is now. I just donated a couple copies to them.
They weren't going to buy it themselves?
Oh, they probably would have, but they dinged. I know this library woman here pretty good, and she cornered me up, and I gave her a couple of them.
Is Drugstore Cowboy based on your own experiences? Did you used to support a habit by robbing drugstores?
Yes, I did, yeah, for 20 years.
But were you out of prison for 20 years?
No. No, but every time I got out, I did that, you know. I got a pharmacy robbery now that I'm doing this 12 years on. Well, I'm doing 22-year sentence. I got about 12, almost 12 of it in.
What was the robbery? What happened?
Just a pharmacy robbery. We went in and robbed it and held it and took the drugs and got away, you know.
Was it armed robbery?
Yes, right. The police were following us at the time that we did it. We got away anyway and went back to Wisconsin. And later on, I got busted in a burglary of a pharmacy back there, and my partner got killed when we were coming out of it. You know?
How come you're in a maximum security prison?
Well, I'm not right now. I'm in a medium facility right outside the maximum, but I was in the maximum for better than 10 years.
I don't understand, though. How did you get into the maximum security prison in the first place? I mean, why maximum in the first place?
Well, I've always been in maximum. I always escape if I ever get a chance. Whenever I get a chance, if I got a lot of time going, I usually escape. You know, I escaped out of the county jail on my beef back in Wisconsin. You know? In fact, almost every case, every sentence I've did, I've escaped at one time or another.
In all the armed robberies that you committed,
right.
Did you ever actually hurt or, you know, wound or kill anyone?
No, I never did. And I never did a lot of robberies. Mostly I was a burglar. I was a crash-and-dash burglar. You know, I'd spot and see where it was in them drugstores, and then I'd just come early in the morning and crash the glass out and run in and grab it and run out. You know, whenever I robbed, I was really pretty desperate, or there was a lot there that I couldn't get no other way or something. Well, I'm not much for that, and I'll tell you, I know everything's got to be right, and I'm not one to hurt. I'd rather shoot myself than shoot somebody in one of them places, because when you do that, you're putting yourself out of, not only are you hurting them and yourself, and you're putting a lot of heat, you're putting yourself out of business, you know. You're going to have problems, you know, and a lot of these guys in here are so dumb. You know, they've been watching that TV so much, and they see all that different crap on there, you know, and they say, man, I'd have shot that guy. I'd have killed him, you know. Man, if I'd have did that, I'd have never survived past my 18th birthday. You know, I'd have been on death row 10 times or something. But the trick is to get in there and get it and get out without hurting anybody, without creating all them problems, you know. And for some reason, I was smart enough to realize that at an early age, you know, and that probably helped me all throughout my life, you know.
Your novel, Drugstore Cowboy, is dedicated to all the poor junkies who fell around you that summer of 1974. What happened in the summer of 1974?
Well, I was living in this apartment, me and that Maybelle Lincoln, and
she was your girlfriend?
Yeah, she was my girlfriend, and there was about seven of us junkies living in this little teeny apartment. We'd go out foraging every day, trying to get enough to keep going each day, you know. And all of them are dead now. The little old man, it was a one-legged old man that owned that apartment. He died of an overdose. And another guy in that same apartment, Red Robbie, he shot a bunch of stuff and went crazy in a bathtub, beat his head against the back of the bathtub until he knocked himself out and drowned in the bathtub. And another one of them guys died of leukemia. And another one committed suicide and on the way to the hospital died of a heart attack. And it just went on and on like that. And another one got killed by some guys coming to that Bobby Emmett. He was selling some stuff, and some people came and killed him and took his stuff, you know. And they were all really close friends of mine, you know. Maybelle got murdered by some lump, you know, in a hotel room. So I just thought, you know, nobody ever going to remember them people, you know what I mean? You know, they were junkies, they were in you know, and so I thought, I always try to do right by everybody, you know, and I never was really sleazy or sorry, you know, and in a lot of respects, I always kept up my word and I kept up my end and I never snitched off my friends. I always did my own time. And I think maybe them people are up there kind of helping me along or something, you know, because they knew I stood up for them and they stood up for me, you know. And who knows, you know.
So in even though you've spent most of your adult life in prison, in a lot of ways, you're the one who survived.
Right, right. And probably that's the reason I did, too. I probably never would have survived had I not spent all these years in prison. I know that I'd really be incapacitated somewhere or another if I hadn't. You're right. It saved me. I was that type of person, you know, that probably prison saved me, yes.
Did you believe in hexes like your character in Drugstore Cowboy did? He always believed, like, if someone put a hat on a bed, that it was bad luck and it was a hex that was going to follow them.
Well, I overdid them characters a little bit, and I over-exemplified that. But when you're running every day, when you're a dope fiend like that, and you're just out running every day committing crimes every day, you haven't got time to plan them out and do this and that, and you're so involved with the element of luck, you know, that pretty soon you start believing, because you have to, you know. You have to have some luck riding with you. You're not gonna last, you know. And you can get caught up in all that. And these friends of mine that, actually, when I wrote that story, I wasn't really writing about myself. I was writing about a couple of friends of mine, and even then, it wasn't really them. It was a kind of a composite of two or three friends of mine, and the things that they had done, this and that.
Was it in prison that you started getting interested in reading and in writing?
Yes, it was. My whole family is storytellers. My mother's a heck of a storyteller. And my dad wasn't too bad, but my dad had a strange way of doing it. He always left the end off for you to put your own imagination and tell it yourself, you know, to yourself. But anyway, in prison, before they had TVs, you're always sitting around these cells, and to pass a time line, you're always telling these stories back and forth, tripping, they call it, you know. And then I started reading a lot. For the first 20 years, I probably read a book a day. You know, I usually have pretty good libraries, and I go to the library and check out four or five books, and I just gnaw my way through them. And pretty soon I start studying them to see why different ones were better than other ones, and the mechanics of it, more or less. And then I started getting the idea that I wanted to try to write some. And then I started trying, and I could see that it wasn't quite as easy as I thought it was going to be. But each time I did one, they started getting a little better, you know. And even then, in the end, I never really thought that they were as good as some people thought they were. But I had hopes that someday that I was going to be able to accomplish that.
James Fogel is my guest. He's an inmate in the Washington State Penitentiary at Walla Walla. The film Drugstore Cowboy was based on his unpublished novel of the same name. Now the novel has just been published. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. James Fogel is my guest, speaking to us by phone from Walla Walla. How did you become a junkie?
Well, I've been in prisons all my life, and I was over at McNeil Island in 1957 to 1962, and at that time they were sending. It was a big thing going on, just like it is right now. You know, they were given all kinds of time, and they were sending them away, and they weren't getting no parole, and they were really down on junkies right then, you know. And a 1956 law came in. I think it was called the Harrison Act or something anyway. But so, but also, all, it ended up all my friends were junkies, you know. I was in prison with them, and I was, they had 10-man cells over there. And everybody I knew was a junkie, and you just sit, it's catching, you know. That's what a lot of people don't really realize, probably, is how catching that is. You're talking to a junkie, and he's talking about it, he almost glows, you know. And it's awful easy to ride right in on that trip, you know. And that's what I did. I got out, and I was just trying to make a living. I started burglarizing them drugstores, just trying to survive. You know? And then I seen them people, and they all wanted that so desperately. And I thought, why do they want it so desperately? Why, you know, there must really be something to it. And then I started getting involved with it myself. You know.
Did you start using again each time you got out of prison?
Yes, usually just as soon as I got out. The last time I got out, I didn't really. I went over and I went to work, and I worked for about a year, and then I just threw up my hands and went back. And for about a year, but every other time I ever got out, I just went immediately, you know, right out, and went right to work on them. You know.
Were you ever afraid of getting sent back to prison, or didn't you care?
Well, I've been in prison so much; it's really my home, you know. You know, that's the one thing about these big sentences, you know. Pretty soon, men, you know, they get to thinking how tough they are to endure what they have. And pretty soon, they start taking a pride in it. You know what I mean? And pretty soon, they think that they're slick and everybody else is dumb, you know. And everything gets all turned around, you know. And that's what happens, you know. And people start living for these prisons, you know.
Let me describe what you say about your character Bob in your novel Drugstore Cowboy. You wrote, "He always did his time with grace. He didn't fight it. He didn't let it beat him. Doing time to Bob was just a good way to regain his health and build up his veins by lifting weights and getting exercise."
That's true, and especially down in California, all them dope fiends are health freaks. But as soon as they hit the joint, they all start lifting weights and running and building up their health for when they get out for some more dope.
You were up for parole in July, weren't you?
Right. Well, I made parole in this state, but I got another. In fact, I also went up for parole in Wisconsin in October, but I haven't heard what's happening yet. They take about a month to tell you what they're gonna do. But I should know here within a week or so just exactly what's gonna happen. And one of two things is gonna happen. I'm either gonna go get out here before Christmas and go to this halfway house over in Olympia, or I'm gonna go back to Wisconsin, and I got 1 year left on that sentence back there. You know.
So you think you won't have to serve out your remaining 12 years?
Well, I only, back in Wisconsin, I got a 22-year sentence, but you only have to do 12-4 on it with your good time. And I've only got I've got less than a year to do on that sentence.
I see.
But in this sentence here, it's a little different. And I had to make parole on it. Well, I have to make parole on that one to get out a year early, too. But both these sentences are running at the same time, is what's happening. They all started in 79.
Well, let me quote something that you say about drugs in Drugstore Cowboy. And this is the main character, Bob, talking, and he's talking to a drug counselor, and he says to her, "Did you ever stop to think that some people hurt so much naturally, are so depressed with life and their role in it, that they can't stand it without an antidote that will bring them some kind of relief? They need something to relieve them of the pressures of their everyday lives." Was that your feeling about yourself?
Yeah, it was. When I was a kid, I had a knot right in the middle of my chest, and it always hurt, you know. And I've grown out of that now, but in a way, I didn't really understand that everybody didn't have it. But then I looked at other people, and I seen other people, and they all always seemed so happy all the time, and they seemed to have something that I didn't have, you know. And I was always looking for that, probably. And you know, when I was a kid, I can never remember it being sunshine. It seemed like it was raining every day. I can never remember almost, you know. Well, I've been in institutions since I was 12 years old. And this state here, you know.
If you get out soon, do you think you'd be able to handle it? And I ask that knowing that every other time you've gotten out, you started using again and robbing again and have ended up back in prison.
Right. I know it. That's the big question. I think I am. This is the first time in my life that I ever got out and had anything, you know. Mostly I got out, I didn't have anything, so I didn't really have anything to lose. And I had to go to stealing to get something to survive, you know. Usually one time I went out and went to work, you know, and I had a job right to go to, and that's the only time in my life that I ever really went out and I blew it, but... But I was younger, too. I'll tell you something. I'm 54 years old now, you know. And when you're a kid, when you're a young kid like that, you're looking for you're picking 1,000 ways trying to kill yourself, you know, with fast cars and drugs. And just look at all the kids, you know. From the time you're a little kid, man, 2 years old, seemingly you're looking for some way to hurt yourself all the way through your life, you know. Then you get to be about 50 years old, and you turn around, you start working the other way. You say, wait a minute, or 40 maybe, you know. I was probably a late comer here, you know. You start saying, whoa, now you start looking for ways of increasing your longevity, you know. And that's where I'm at now. I haven't smoked a cigarette in 10 years. I don't drink any more coffee than I have to. I don't want to eat no sugar. I go out and run every morning. And I'm on a whole different trip, you know, more or less. And I just write about that stuff. Now, I don't do it anymore. I have the chance to use it. If I wanted to use some narcotics right now, I could, but I don't. You know, that isn't me anymore, you know.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
All right. Thanks to you, Terry.
James Fogel spoke to us from the Washington State Penitentiary at Walla Walla. His novel, Drugstore Cowboy, was published today. The movie adaptation is running throughout November on the Showtime cable network. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, are you commemorating the anniversary of the opening of the Berlin Wall?
We are, Terry, and we also have news coming out of Germany again today. Such an extraordinary year it has been there. We also are following the Secretary of State on his march around the world. He is in Europe now. The Daily News strike is also on our show, together with a story about New York City and their budget. We will be talking about how people in America feel about the commitment of troops to the Persian Gulf, and we'll be looking at an amazing trial in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The winner of England's prestigious Booker Prize this year is the novel Possession by A.S. Byatt. It's being compared to Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose and John Fowle's The French Lieutenant's Woman because it's a story that interweaves past and present, and it uses literary critics as detectives. Commentator Maureen Corrigan says it also contains one of the ghastliest Victorian wedding night scenes she's ever read.
Wow. That's what one character says about the shocking secret unearthed at the end of Possession. And it's what I said when I finished the novel. Wow! Possession is a mesmerizing Victorian monstrosity of a book. Part romance, detective story, fairy tale, academic farce, epic poem, and gothic thriller. It's over 500 pages long, just like the 19th century blockbusters it copies. Possession probably should be savored slowly, but I couldn't restrain myself. I read most of it on Tuesday night, with election returns blaring in the background. For all I knew, Boris Yeltsin and Bart Simpson might have won Senate seats. The sorry world of late 20th century politics faded away as soon as I began to read. Possession made good on the promise of its title. The novel is mostly about the illicit love affair of two Victorian poets, Randolph Henry Ashe, who's modeled on Robert Browning, and Christabel Lamotte, a Christina Rossetti clone. A century later, a young scholar named Roland Mitchell discovers evidence of their affair when he finds a love letter to Lamotte in one of Ashe's old library books. Roland consults a Lamotte scholar named Maud Bailey. She's a fierce feminist deconstructionist critic who's been working to reclaim Lamotte as a lesbian poet. The two scholars are quickly joined by other bloodhounds who've sniffed the moldy odor of a literary scandal. A.S. Byatt has a lot of fun here, mimicking the bizarre language of literary academics. She also has a wonderful ear for Victorian phrasing, and she generates tons of authentic-sounding journals, poems, and letters that furnish the scholars with clues about the love affair. It's like Byatt herself has been possessed by the spirit of a George Eliot or Emily Bronte. The Lamotte-Ashe love letters in particular are masterpieces of the convoluted Victorian language of sex. Christabel Lamotte calls Ashe a fiery salamander and writes of seeing shooting stars and licking flames in her fireplace. Ashe responds by telling her that their love will be a pyre from which you, my phoenix, shall fly up renewed. Reading all this elegantly steamy stuff makes Roland and Maud hot, and they find themselves falling in love. They compulsively retrace the secret journeys of Lamotte and Ashe from London to Yorkshire to France, and finally to the graveyard where Ashe and his wife Ellen are buried. I don't want to spoil the ending. I'll just tell you that the novel unfolds through a series of narrative boxes nested one within another, and it comes to a spectacular climax when a real box is exhumed from Ashe's grave on a dark and stormy night. Hokey, sure, but it's also irresistible. Underneath all its sophisticated narrative pyrotechnics and hip allusions to literary theory, Possession is an old-fashioned, thumping good yarn, only masquerading as a postmodernist parody.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Possession by A.S. Byatt. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person. Our interviews are produced by Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers, with production assistance from Joan Tui and Roberta Shurrock. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Albie Sachs tells us about his life as a white member of the African National Congress. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new adaptation of Stephen King's novel, It. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.